Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we'll be listening to a panel discussion on the future of extrapolation. The panelists include science fiction authors Octavia Butler, Glenn Grant, Jeff Hecht, Patrick Hayden, Graham Slate, and Shane Tortelot. They were speaking on July 14, 2002, at the 14th Annual ReaderCon, a conference on literary science fiction held every summer outside of Boston. For more information about the conference, you can go to ReaderCon.org.
My name is Graham Slate, and I'm a critic. I write for the New York Review of Science Fiction, principally. It's not a science fictional example, but I think it was Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone, who said that he envisaged one day every major American city having as many as 10 telephones.
I'm Patrick Nelson Hayden. I run the science fiction line at Tor Books, and I'm 43 years old, and I think I've been living in the science fictional future my entire life. I was born 2 years after Sputnik, you know. So I kind of feel like this panel, nominally at least, this panel topic could have been held and probably was held in any convention in the last 40 years. I mean, certainly we can talk about examples of science fictional extrapolation that have kind of prevented themselves from coming about. I think that 1984 is arguably one of the most influential novels of the century. It probably has, served as a touchstone for people trying to keep 1984 from happening. Whether Orwell was really thinking like a science fictional extrapolator or more like a fabulist is a whole other question. But certainly, I think that science fiction images and nightmares and fears and so forth have had effects on the mainstream world, on the way we think about our political present and our political potential. I don't know how specifically you want to get about those. Over to you.
I'm Octavia Butler, and I have an odd feeling about this particular panel, maybe just because it's the last one, but several years ago I went to a convention in New York City. It was a convention of black women, and it was called the Yari Yari Conference. And the meaning of that was supposed to be, in which language I don't know, but the meaning was supposed to be the future of the future. And that's sort of what this panel is about. Now we have failed to attain the future that we kind of expected, particularly in space travel. I mean, remember back in the 50s when we figured by now we'd have colonies on Mars and, be headed out to the stars and...
Moon Base Alpha. What happened to Moon Base Alpha?
Oh, God. I was speaking to a high school class last year, and one of the students asked me about Parable of the Sower, which I think they've read. She said, why did you place it so close in time? Why did you just make it 2024? That seems not such a long time ahead. And I said, it used to be.
Great. I'm your moderator. I'm Glenn Grant. I'm a science fiction writer, as well as a critic and editor and illustrator. And I kind of wonder at my own obsession with trying to forecast the future. For the last 20 years or so, I've been keeping timelines and writing scenarios, and I take futurology quite seriously. I don't know why I do. It's this obsessive thing. I know that it's almost pointless. You're never going to get it right, except by accident. You write enough extrapolations, and one of them is bound to come true, and then you can boast it about it at conventions for the rest of your life. I forecast the fall of the Soviet Union.
That's
or
pretty
something.
Much what Jean Dixon yeah. did. She more or less predicted Kennedy's assassination and traded on it for the rest of her career.
And we might as well continue introducing ourselves.
My name is Shane Tortelot. I'm a science fiction writer, mostly an analog. I'm on the Hugo ballot this year for my novel At the Return of Spring. As for bad extrapolations, I think there was some time in the late 1940s when IBM projected that there might one day be a world market for, I think it was, three of their supercomputers.
Yes. Which were probably somewhat slightly less powerful than the average pocket calculator today. I'm Jeff Hecht. I write for the Global Science magazine, New Scientist, formerly called British. I also write a little science fiction. I've written a lot about fiber optic telecommunications and optics, and my favorite example of the prediction that didn't go right was picture phone, which the video telephone, which in fact, I was flipping through a book today and reminded that the original visions for television were for two-way communication back in the 1920s, that AT&T Bell Laboratories was developing two-way communication by a picture phone. And I was in a conversation a couple of years ago at the MIT Media Lab, had a seminar, and I got talking at lunch with someone, and I said, oh, you know, video conferencing is really a particularly exciting application. And he looked at me and said, you're a neo-Luddite. video conferencing still is a rarity outside of certain corporate.
How many of us want it?
Exactly.
I mean, who needs it?
Exactly. It was interesting.
Who wants to have to get dressed to answer the phone?
Well, what was very interesting was the New York Times had a headline on page one. It was actually sort of at the bottom. But where they first turned on picture phone in Pittsburgh in July 1 of 1970, a new age in telecommunications begins. On a follow-up article on July 1, 1971, they buried somewhere on page 28 the news that, well, it had been 35 picture phones operating and now there were 32.
Here's an example of, I believe it was Arthur C. Clarke who said that the future comes too soon and in the wrong order. We got television, but it was one way, and then now we have computers. Everyone can buy a webcam and transmit rather poor two-way video on the net, but who does except for porn sites? You know, nobody.
A few exhibitionists.
Pornography has been a major driver of communications technologies for at least a century, and if not longer.
So there's something we've learned.
Well, Glenn, you mentioned Arthur C. Clarke. We haven't mentioned the most iconic missed extrapolation so far, the Pan Am space plane from 2001, Space Odyssey. Not only do we not have space planes, we do not have Pan Am. 2001 also had picture phones, which we do not have. Picture phones by Ma Bell, which we do not have.
You can't have one thing right, though. Everything is corporate branded.
Well, in fact, 2001 is a terrific movie about 1968. That's the thing. Science fiction is always about the present that it's written in. The science fiction's futures are always tethered to a particular point in time. It is a way of science fiction has never fundamentally been about extrapolating the future. Fun though that is,
would you consider it a mark of quality in a science fiction book if you were not able to determine the year in which it was written by the method of its execution?
Not particularly, no. I mean, that might be interesting or not, as the case may be, but I certainly don't consider it a mark against a science fiction book,
if it's a work of its time.
If
you were reading a book and saying, this was something nice, I wonder why I didn't hear it when it came out a few years ago, and you found out it was released in 1961.
Well, that would be interesting, I suppose.
There are authors who have declined to specify what future era, what future year they're talking about, sometime in the near future.
That's probably safer.
And not really, because immediately when they start naming things that no longer exist and that stopped existing shortly after the book came out.
And an excellent example of a science fiction novel that's absolutely rooted in its time is The Space Merchants by Poland Kernblad. That's a novel about the 50s. It's in some ways it's an overt extrapolation of advertising culture gone crazy, but it's also, it's just about the things that people are concerned about in the 1950s, and it is a way of dramatizing and heightening and sharpening those concerns by using science fiction narrative techniques. And of course, you know, science fiction will often stumble on actual future extrapolation, and that can be interesting too, but I don't think that's the primary job of science fiction. I don't actually think people read it for that. I don't think people pick up a science fiction magazine going, gee, I'll see what I'll be doing in 2015, unless they're particularly thick.
That's generally what outsiders think science fiction is.
Indeed.
When you're interviewed for the daily newspaper or something, they assume that, of course, you're giving ridiculous prophecies, you know. They kind of want you to. So that
are you ever tempted to play into that?
No.
put on a robe and say, my son.
I deny it when they accuse me of it.
Look, there's a market for prophecy.
Yeah.
I must admit, as a writer, I do aim for a certain literary effect by which I try to convince the reader that what they are reading
absolutely.
Yeah, the future that you are going to be living in 20, 40, 30 years from now. Yeah, and that requires me to do a lot of research into what's coming up the pipe, what they're working on at MIT, and then try to work out, you know, how that's going to influence society and the fabric of people's lives.
Absolutely. One of the things... Oh, sorry.
If, as I read it, the rubric of this panel is, we seem to be more constrained in what futures we can write about.
I think that people have been saying, you know, viewing this problem with alarm and saying, you know, science fiction has run out of things to be science fiction about for 50 years, and it's never been true. I don't see any lack of futuristic invention and fascinating prognostication in the backgrounds of modern science fiction. I think Bruce Sterling's Distraction is one of the great modern science fiction novels, and it's just full of that stuff, you know. Telephones printed on cloth that people use and throw away. You know,
bricks that talk to you and tell you where to put
and
them.
And it's all perfectly plausible based on what we're working on right now. And 50 years from now, when we're actually in 2050, which is when the book is set, it'll probably look ridiculous, but it will probably still be a very readable and entertaining book.
People will be saying, wow, what a great novel about the 90s that was.
Exactly. I'm sure Bruce would be the first to agree.
Yeah. Well, I think Oscar is just, when the book started, he's just had a couple of dot-com successes. So, you know, I think that dates it to 98.
Right.
Is there something to be learned from extrapolations that people got right, astonishingly? The example I always choose when people ask me what's the best prognostication in science fiction, I would say The Sheep Look Up by John Brunner. I feel is perhaps the most accurate forecast of the future I've ever seen in science fiction. It was about, you know, an ecological disaster that we managed to avert, perhaps because of these novels. But it was also about an American president from California who was an ex-actor. And this was written in 1970-71, remember.
So Reagan had been governor for 4 or 5 years.
Who was intent on getting the United States involved in an anti-communist war in Honduras. There's all kinds of things in that book that are dead on. One of the characters is infected with antibiotic-resistant gonorrhea, which didn't exist at the time, but, you know, that was an easy one to call, I think. And the commercial popularity of water filters, which seemed like an outrageous idea in the 60s, that people would buy water filters and put them on their tap, you know, because the tap water was not safe, and that this would become completely accepted and people wouldn't even, you know, think that this was a strange thing. That was a radical extrapolation at the time he wrote it. Nowadays, people, you know, don't even think about this. They don't even expect their water to be pure.
And everyone carries around little bottles of water.
Yeah.
Tom Lehrer was saying about don't drink the water and don't breathe the air in 1964.
I'm not sure I'm as impressed with the Sheep Look Up on those scores as you are. I mean, I was a child of liberal parents in 1971, and it sounds like all the liberal PNAs that I grew up with, some of which I still agree with, and some of which turned out to be not true.
And that's when Earth Day started.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I remember the early environmental movement. I remember Paul Ehrlich's Population Bomb, which has more errors in it than words. I mean, everything he forecast failed to come to pass.
But there is a tradition of the prophecy of doom, that the goal of which is to avoid.
Sure.
the lesson I drew from Sheep Look Up is that it was very much a satirical novel that exaggerated 1970 to an absurd extent, and it kind of scares me that I find the most accurate forecasts of the future are written by satirists. Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash, I think, is going to prove to be a very prescient novel.
If we can,
but it's very much a satire.
If we can move slightly out of the genre, how many people today think Paddy Chayefsky's Network is more plausible today than it was in the mid-1970s? I think the one thing he missed was the explosion of cable TV, but really, he wasn't trying to extrapolate the future. He was trying to take the present to its logical extreme.
Yeah.
He wasn't writing science fiction, but... he was writing
all too often, that's what we do. We take the present to some maybe illogical extreme, you know.
And it's quite frightening that that is exactly what tends to happen in history. we head towards this extreme until we pull back from the brink and realize.
But what happens in history is never what happens in science fiction, because what happens in history is all kinds of other stuff comes out of left field.
Yes.
The science fictional method of taking one thing and exaggerating it so that you have a world run by dog food manufacturers, you know, the streets of New York are buried in horse shit or whatever.
Or shoe manufacturers.
It doesn't actually work as an extrapolatory device for looking at reality, because something, you know, because nobody can encompass everything, every trend that's going on in the world.
The wild cards.
Not even brilliant futurologists. You know, just who among the environmental activists of the early 70s, you know, who I have tremendous sympathy with, I think of myself as an environmentalist, but who is forecasting that along with all these dire pollution and environmental degradation trends, that the eastern half of the United States would become hugely reforested in the next 30 years, which it has. I mean, you know, people do, I don't know, people don't remember driving from New York to Boston 30 years ago and how totally different it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I think that quite rationally people tend to, when they're drawing their trend lines, people tend to deliberately be a little pessimistic for safety's sake. And the you know, the addition of all these different bits of slight pessimism on the part of a lot of fairly smart, clearly clued in prognosticators tends to often create a slightly more dystopian picture than is necessarily the case. And then again, of course, you know, something will come out of left field and clobber us in a very negative way as well.
Or sometimes it's just a matter of a cautionary tale.
Yeah.
Or a dramatic necessity.
Sure.
We want to exaggerate it. We want a dark future because it
provides
makes for an exciting story.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to have that powerful dog food industry to go up against.
When you're working on something, have you ever fought back the number of years that you're thinking ahead? If you're doing near future, say, you know, you're thinking 30 years ahead, mm-hmm. and you think back 30 years as to just how different was it really?
Yes.
And it's remarkable how similar it was in many ways. I mean, okay, we didn't have, you know, the computers as we do now and all that, but it didn't make that much difference, really.
Well, I don't know about that.
No, I mean, you could still, you know, get on an airplane, fly from coast to coast. You could still do pretty much what you do today. Sometimes it took longer, was more awkward, but you could do it.
It does seem to me that
the...
But now the destinations you can fly to Moscow.
No, it does seem to me that
time 30 years ago would have presented some problems.
Not really.
Well, it depends. You couldn't fly to Moscow and set up a trade arrangement.
But
you know,
you would have had a more civilized flight.
Yes,
you know, a more comfortable flight.
You would have gone on Finnair the way I did.
Yeah.
It does seem to me that the amount of just sort of social change on the hand level detail, everyday middle class American level, leaving aside all kinds of other people in the world, amount of change between say 1930 and 1965, 35 years, is actually arguably more than between 1965 and 2000.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, yes, air travel is certainly cheaper than it was in 1965 and in 2000 and so forth, but, you know, a great deal of the basic texture of daily life is more similar than it is different.
I'm sorry. I would think the huge difference would be, and you said 1930 to 65?
Yeah, 1965.
Think about 1900 to 1930.
Well, there's
that's huge.
That's even arguably huger. You're right.
Mm.
I mean, electrification is just a gigantic thing, which in some ways, you know, the next two 35-year periods are simply getting used to and working on.
Finding new things to do with that, yes.
This is interesting, because usually everyone argues that the pace of change in our world, technologically at least, is extrapolating.
That's
but now we're saying that
I don't think it's always...
Sorry.
accelerating, you're trying to say.
But it seems, but it also seems that the rate of social change is decelerating.
Sometimes. I think the biggest single change I think the biggest single change in daily life in the world in the last 200 years happened to much of the world in the late 19th century, and has been, you know, percolating out of the rest of the world throughout the remaining time, which is the electric light, which completely changes us as an organism. It screws up our sleep cycles. We're still getting over it. But the electric light more than anything else. It's like the impact of distilled spirits on societies. Yeah, basically, societies, once they get the distilled spirits, it usually takes them 100 or 200 years to learn to cope with it, for it to not be this tremendous drug abuse, substance abuse problem. I mean, Denmark as a country was drunk for 100 years.
And now, boy, are they hungover.
And the electric light is like that. It's really screwed us up in a lot of ways. It's empowered us tremendously.
I think there's something else too. I was speaking at a high school a while back, and a young girl, for some reason, I think I was talking about xenogenesis, and I mentioned Reagan and nuclear war, and she said it didn't seem to her that there had ever been a problem with nuclear war, because it would be stupid, you know, why? And I couldn't decide whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, you know, that she had no memory of it.
Yeah.
I think that the major change that happened in the early 20th century, late 19th century, that in many ways created science fiction as a popular genre, was the slow realization among the masses, among the populace, that the future was going to be different
within the scope of their lives.
Yes, it was whereas previously no one assumed that the future would be different.
They assumed that it would be, but in a very slow moving.
And I think the major change that we now have looking back on the 20th century is that now everyone's become used to the idea that this constant change of
you actually see this ways of life. Before the invention of science fiction as a commercial genre, I mean, you know, Henry James with his whole constant imagery about the dynamo and so forth. You really start getting that in American literature in the late 19th century. But yes, I absolutely agree that science fiction is, you know, modern American commercial science fiction is at heart about the emotional experience of knowing that in your life the world is going to change in possibly unrecognizable ways.
Something that this reminds me of that I think is significant. I read and sort of enjoyed reading Barbara Tuchman's A Distant Mirror. And in it she talks about the plague and how it kind of, for its era, invented the idea of social change.
Yes.
I mean, all of a sudden, you didn't have to be a serf all your life, even though your grandfather's back to the how many a generation had been served.
Because there's a lot of fields to be tilled, mm-hmm. lots of people to till them. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of other positions open, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Question, which is, does anybody know when the notion of progress as this sort of thing that would happen came along? Because, I mean, if you look at it, if you sort of look back in history, if you look at Homer, you know, he's always constantly describing these characters who single-handedly lift a rock which 10 men today could not lift, and you know we have to be constantly saying we're not half the men that our forefathers who sacked Troy were, and you know you'll have the same thing in the Periclean age that this reading has come along and it's destroying our memory and all the rest of us.
We're in a fallen state.
Yeah, we're in a fallen state, and it's kind of interesting. There must be some point at which.
As a piece of political language, it's an artifact of the mid to late 19th century. You know, you first get people describing them to their political position as progressive, and meaning that as a good thing in about the 1870s, and they're mostly Republicans.
Whereas the Republic, for instance, argues that you know you have to keep a close watch on those engineers.
That's why
I didn't use the word, but you know
that's why Plato will be first up against the wall when
stop change from happening. Yes,
and why? I mean, certainly a couple of instances bring to mind in Britain where left wing politicians like Harold Wilson have identified themselves with technology, with the forces of progress in that sense.
Well, you know, the other interesting thing, the point you raise, is that during the 19th century, there was a tension about the mechanization of society. The Luddites opposed, the symbolic opposition, and certainly the most visible opposition. But if you listen to the folk song John Henry, the man who wrote the steam drill that outdid, that John Henry beat and died beating.
Henry Dickens, Hard Times.
Yeah. I think also one of the real turning points has got to be the English Civil War. The point of which, really the first point in modern Western history where a bunch of people who weren't part of the power structure just up and said, "Wait a minute, we're just going to throw this all over and take over." And it had happened again in 1688, a different bunch of people, and then the American Revolution and the French Revolution. And those are like the images of progress, of breaking out of a world of endless cyclical history into a world of linear history.
By the 1960s, science fiction was initially fairly optimistic. Granted, it was always looking at mad scientists, delving into matters that they were not intended to, man was not meant to know. But that was, another example of requiring a dramatic story, but for the most part, people were very optimistic about the future possibilities of technology.
And I think a lot of readers of stories like that were secretly identifying with the mad scientists.
With the new wave, there was a big transformation, people started to argue that, technology and progress and all these things were not necessarily good things. And today, that's been basically assimilated into science fiction as a whole. There aren't too many people who are, complete technophiliacs in science fiction these days. They generally are more aware that technologies involve a lot of, problems.
Certainly, not all the new wave was technophobic either. I mean, J.G. Ballard is about as technophilic as you can possibly get. This is a man who wants to have sex with automobiles, and who has said many times in public interviews that he modeled his style after his literary hero Isaac Asimov.
But he never seemed to believe that we had a destiny in space, for instance.
No. But he loves technology. It's the coolest thing.
But this idea that the technology would inevitably lead to a golden future, he didn't seem to believe in that at all. He made fun of Buckminster Fuller, for instance, in his fiction.
A more meticulous, sir.
And I'm where I'm going with all this is to ask people where they think science fiction is today in this how have we changed our visions of the future?
I think that as far as being pro or against technology, it's sort of like fishes being for or against water.
Yes.
We are totally caught up in it.
Hence Neuromancer, the future is no longer a project for the character.
Right, very, very cool. Yes, exactly.
To hack.
I wonder,
it's now an environment that they're in, and they can't really do anything about it.
I wonder if it's still, though, as much fun as it was. I mean, there's the idea of the gray of science fiction. Mm-hmm. Is looking forward as much fun as it once was.
Mm-hmm. That was the panel last hour.
Yes.
Oh, really?
I was sitting right here. I'm Bob Dibney over here.
Hard to believe we've reached this point in this panel without mentioning the word singularity.
Oh, yes, there you go. Yes. In fact, and I think that's compelling because it is, as in your words, a new kind of progressive futuristic project.
Yes. Are we going to assume here that everybody knows what we're talking about when we talk about the singularity?
No.
Okay, you'll have to read The Spike by Damian Broderick,
several things by Vernon Vinge, who coined the term.
Vernon Vinge, who...
Basically the idea that sometime in the foreseeable future, whether 10 years from now or 50 years from now or 100 years from now, we will hit a point of progress, a kind of steep curve, point of no return, beyond which we will essentially be building AIs or things that then go on to build things more intelligent than us, and that essentially the future beyond that point, the singularity, is literally unknowable because it will be out of our hands.
Yes. We will simply be either super beings or these.
There is a wonderful scene in the middle of Ken MacLeod's novel, The Cassini Division. It's a flashback on the part of the woman who's the main character to an argument she had as a young woman in the mid-21st century on an orbital platform with somebody who is basically a big sort of extropian. And the extropians is a modern fringe political movement of people who want to become more than human, cloning and postulate future biotech sciences to become men like gods, etc. And she's arguing against this. She's arguing for a different version of the future in which which, you know, humans, as we know humans, triumph and rule the universe. And she realizes in the middle of the argument that, you know, that essentially she is arguing two 20th century, this argument is two 20th century science fictional visions against each other. She says, you know, it's the Federation versus the singularity, and I want to be the queen of the Federation.
I think with nanotechnology and other technologies, biotech to some extent, we are increasingly seeing in science fiction this debate between whether or not there will be a singularity.
Whether the future is human or not,
go.
Basically.
I'm sorry?
Whether the future is human or not.
Undesirable, but I mean, it's another thing to caution people about, actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think whether the present economic trends may dim some of the luster of the singularity. I mean, not seem so inevitable anymore that every day, every way, things are building higher and higher.
I was thinking as we've been sitting here that the utopians of today about the future, or the utopians of recent years about the future, are the market forecasters. And in going through the telecommunications bubble, one of the fascinating things to see was the people who would extrapolate the sales of some new technology on an exponential curve from one data point. And it would go, you know, always through the roof, and you'd have infinite.
Well, wasn't Cisco's entire business model predicated on the idea that every man, woman, and child on the planet would buy 5 routers by 2002?
And buy twice as many next year.
Routers, can't get enough of them.
I guess the reason I said that is my question, because that singularity point. At some point the bubble pops.
Yeah, sure.
The economy popped. Not every, you know, the world did not all become.
People just have enough tulips, thank you.
Yes.
But nonetheless, some processes do in fact run out of control. Like plagues. The whole notion of the singularity of this fabulous out of control nanotech driven change, adding the really pertinent question, wait a minute, do we want this? I mean, as human beings, as actual incarnate human beings, should we be like enthusiastic about super powerful, omniscient, godlike successors, or should we like be trying to isolate them, cut them off, and kill them before they do it to us?
Okay. We're down one minute, so anybody want to tie this off?
We have no idea what's going to happen.
Yes. We have a forecast for the future of extrapolation.
William Goldman, who wrote...
You get it wrong again.
Absolutely.
William Goldman, who wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, said, nobody knows anything.
Right. In a book about writing, it was a wonderful book.
Thank you all for coming here.
Today on Change Surfer Radio, we've been listening to a panel on the future of extrapolation. The panelists included science fiction authors Octavia Butler, Glenn Grant, Jeff Hecht, Patrick Hayden, Graham Slate, and Shane Tortolot. They were speaking on July 14, 2002, at the 14th Annual ReaderCon, a conference on literary science fiction held every summer outside of Boston. For more information about the conference, you can go to ReaderCon.org. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.